On March 7th, journalist and entrepreneur Steve Brill visited ProPublica for a brown bag lunch talk. We wanted to ask him questions about his thoughtful deep dive investigation of healthcare spending and the billing practices of hospitals. The piece, titled Bitter Pill, Why Medical Bills Are Killing Us, was long even by ProPublica standards. But it was the kind of ambitious journalism that we like, and we wanted to quiz him about it. And as the founder of Press Plus, American Lawyer, and Court TV, among others, we wanted to pick his brain about the state of the media. The following is an edited version of that conversation. Please pardon the sound. It was a brown bag lunch, after all. We began by asking him, what was the impact of his bitter pill investigation?
Well, first of all, just to come back, I had a thought on the way down in terms of Time magazine and the viability of this kind of journalism. There may be some lessons lurking here, which is I gave a talk to the marketing department at Time on Monday. This arose out of a request I got from Nancy Gibbs and Rick Stengel if they could quote something that I said on the Time website about the reaction to the piece, if they could quote that in a meeting they were going to have with the marketing people. Such is the sanctity of the separation of church and state at Time, Inc., that they asked my permission to quote something that was public on their website, which I thought was kind of odd. And I said, what are you kidding? I mean, you can quote it to anyone. It's there. I said, but I'll come talk to them about what you guys did and the commitment. I mean, they said, you would? We've never had a reporter do that. I said, sure, why not? It's not like I'm going to get contaminated by these people. They're, they're business people, and they're actually important to your enterprise. After I gave that talk, I was coming down the elevator, and a woman who is involved in marketing subscriptions to their website and their iPad subscriptions said they had sold 5 or 6 times as many, iPad subscriptions as they had ever in the any month in that week. Mm-hmm. And I was also told that the newsstand sales had sold out, which was supposedly pretty rare for Time, which is no surprise. So if you take the fee that they paid me to write the article, which was actually substantial, but basically it filled the entire editorial section of their magazine in one fell swoop, that was actually a pretty decent business model for them. I'll just preface what I'm saying with that. And my general outlook on life is I still think there's a way to make good journalism pay. I love the success that you guys have had, but I always have this sort of fear that if journalism depends on the kindness of strangers writ large, that's a real problem. You guys have donors who have been, really terrific about your independence and everything else, and I don't have any question about that, but I do have a question about the degree to which you can create and extend that model, into Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or, Bakersfield, California, which worries me a lot. I think that we all have an obligation in some way or another to figure out how to make this work, and in the course of doing this article and thinking about this article, I sort of made my first terrible mistake thinking about that more than I thought about the article.
What do you hope is going to come out of that article?
What any journalist hopes comes out of something, which has a lot of it has happened, which is it affects the debate, even changes the debate. What I don't want to have come out of it from a personal standpoint is I've gotten, people saying, you should testify in Congress and stuff like that. Well, that's not my job. I mean, I'm not on any side of anything. I just wrote a story, and a lot of people have read it and responded to it, and that's great. That's what all of us here want to do. You don't want to end up leading a cause or anything, but you want to, contribute to the debate. I've always been a big believer that policy debates don't really matter unless, people like the people in this room are sort of filling in the facts around those policy debates. I've always thought that as an editor, I would sort of habitually, not that there was that much occasion for it, but I never wanted anyone working for me to go to a press conference, at the White House. You don't get anything out of that. I always like the kind of reporting that takes whatever someone says policy is and sees whether how and whether it's working on the ground. You know, just like the sequester, you know, I assume, you know, some of the good reporting that's coming out of it is, you know, someone seeing, you know, is anything slower at any airport? Or is any food not getting inspected? And what's the consequence of that? This is just an example of that sort of writ very large, which is, I just always was baffled by the debates over healthcare, which always started with the premise that everything is, you know, costs $1 zillion and it's super expensive, and if you have cancer, it's $1 million, and if you slip and fall and you go to the emergency room, it's $25,000, and the debate was over who should pay for it. Instead of, well, you know, how come it's $25,000? I mean, I'm still waiting to see, and my colleagues at Time, actually, I don't think did this either, but, you know, in something like the giant Lockheed plane is, and the debate is, you know, should we spend, what is it, $400 billion, some ridiculous stuff. Well, why does each of those planes cost that much money? Take it apart, tire by tire, piece by piece, who's making all the money there? Why do we just accept that? You know, what percent of that is profit for Lockheed Martin? And who died and said they have to get a 7%, you know, carry on all their hours and all their parts and all their labor? Why? We shouldn't advocate changing it, but if people knew that that was the rule, there might be some debate about it. So the piece is really, you know, it's not any great act of genius. It's just an act of patience, just taking bills line by line and sort of using them to figure things out. You know, you sent me some of your bills, which I didn't use. I did. Don't worry, he's not in the piece. Right. But in looking at them, it helped inform me, for example, as to whether Medicare is really unfair to doctors, even in Manhattan. Your doctor's reimbursement from an insurance company in the middle of Manhattan is basically 1% or 2% more than what the doctor would have gotten if you were a Medicare patient. So it's hard to say that, you know, your doctor's losing money on Medicare, which also is evidenced by the fact that 94% of all the doctors in the country take Medicare. If they were all losing money on it, that, you know, there is a 13th Amendment. They do not have to accept patients with Medicare. No one says they have to. So, you know, it was really just very basic grunt work reporting.
Was there anything about this that departed in any significant way from what you expected?
Everything, actually. My assumption, I don't want to say assumption because, you know, that implies that actually, you know, given it a lot of thought, but my assumption was that our care was a lot better and a lot more meticulous, that everybody along the supply chain did well, including the hospital workers. You know, if you've just, you know, spent some time doing a piece about how, you know, the teachers unions are screwing up, you know, public education in New York and making it more expensive. You know, we spend more money per student on a conventional public school in Harlem than the most heavily funded of the charter schools spends per student on a school in Harlem. So if you sort of come out of that mindset, I just assumed there had to be a lot of other factors at work and not the factors that I saw. I mean, who knew that your average nonprofit hospital in Oklahoma City or in Stamford, Connecticut, is the most profitable business in town with the highest paid administrators and the highest paid, you know, marketing director. The marketing director of the typical local hospital is, you know, making more money than the CEO of most of the companies in town. Who knew? What do they have to market anyway if they're the only hospital in town? You know, get sick? So, no, I mean, the whole thing, and that's in large part because I knew nothing about the subject, literally nothing about the subject. I mean, if I have one virtue, it's that I'm not intimidated to sort of, you know, to dive into things that I know nothing about. I'm never afraid to ask really stupid questions at the beginning. When I'm interviewing people and they use acronyms, I always stop them and say, what does that mean? Even though it's an acronym that is like branded onto their forehead because they use it every day. And I used to teach my reporters that. I remember when Connie Brock started on her great Mike Milken piece that then became a book, she knew nothing about what a junk bond was. I mean, she literally, couldn't have told you in the simplest terms what a junk bond was. And I said, well, who cares? What is it? You know, you're smart. You'll figure it out. Just ask people what a junk bond is. So I didn't know any of this stuff, let alone the CPT codes and all that garbage. You know, I've never even been sick that much.
Steve, one of the organizations that, at least for me, came off worst in this is Memorial Sloan Kettering, one of the best respected hospitals in this town, one of the biggest charities in this town. Have you had any reaction from them?
Yeah, they were really glad I included MD Anderson, which came off a lot worse. I don't think Sloan Kettering comes off bad or good. And again, we have to put this in the context of these people do wake up every morning and work in a place that cures the sick. Okay? It's not like they're all doing this against the backdrop of producing the most violent video game. Their work has a good cause behind it. And in their case, you know, maybe I've just mellowed a lot with age. Whenever you have basic unaccountable power, people just sort of lapse into these abuses without ever necessarily understanding that they have, or without there ever being some sort of critical moment where they say, okay, let's be bad. It just happens. And if you're running a hospital and some consultant says, well, the peer group report is that, you know, you should be making $4.5 million a year, it sounds pretty good. And besides, all our peers make it, so why is that a bad thing? Or everyone's doing this, you should, I found that when I started, as you know, writing about, you know, law firms, which were completely unaccountable, making tons of money. And when I started writing about them, my wife was an associate at a law firm, and she had to go through the side door of the eating club when they recruited her. So I don't think they woke up in the morning to be bad people. It just sort of happened. And this whole industry, healthcare, has been allowed to just sort of drift into this state, albeit with now, in the last 10 years, with the heaviest lobbying that you can imagine to defend all of this stuff.
I thought that was particularly interesting that they spent more than the energy companies.
Three or four times more. Yeah. I mean, the energy, you know, the oil and gas companies are homeless people compared to them. much more. And they have a political advantage that an oil and gas company doesn't have, which is when it comes to hospitals, certainly not necessarily the drug companies, but hospitals, they're the most popular institution in town. I mean, the one thing that will come of this is, if people read the article, they're not going to go to the charity dinners anymore, because the charity dinners are basically their PR stunts, except for Sloan Kettering, which actually, not so much at the dinner, but they raise a lot of money. But most hospitals, the philanthropy, whether it's gifts or the annual charity dinner or whatever else they do, it's 0.5% to 1% of what their revenue is. You know, they make more money on gauze pads than they make on charity dinners. But the constituency is, any town is pretty strong. That's the hospital where your kids were born, and most of the time nothing bad happened. It's the hospital where you can go if you get sick. It provides all these jobs in the community, good, steady jobs for people at all levels. If you're insured, you don't really have any beef with the bills. One of the great ways that they're able to maintain political support that they have, the whole industry, is that you get a bill for $200,000 and it says your share of it is $1,800. You say, my God, that's the greatest thing in the world. Is this a great country or what? You know, the insurance company paid, you know, $60,000 of the $200,000. The hospital discounted the rest because the $200,000 was fiction to start with. And everybody's happy.
So let me ask you a question about that. In the solutions part, which I think is almost always the hardest part for journalists to write.
No, certainly the weakest part of the article.
You talked a lot in the article about how Medicare actually does a good job. You had some criticisms, but you were saying that it has a lower overhead than the privates, that it has been, within the scheme of American healthcare, fairly good at getting a decent price. Mm-hmm. And then in the sort of solutions part, based on that, I was thinking, okay, he's probably going to say something like, you know, Medicare for all, or at least the option to buy into Medicare, you know, if you're lower than 65 or something like that. And that didn't come up. So just...
Well, I sort of hinted at it. And I actually made... I did something that I actually have not done, at least that I can remember anything I've written before, which is I made a strategic decision, not so much to pull my punch at the end, because I'm not sure that's right, but I didn't want the reporting to get distracted or overshadowed by coming out for some, you know, great solution. And there were actually a lot of reasons, not the least of which is a lot of really smart people for 30 years have been debating this stuff. And again, I was really just sort of jumping in, and I really didn't feel very sure-footed about it. I actually feel much better about it now that I've had a chance to read all the critiques of the article. But the critiques basically go, you know, one of two ways. On the, let's call it the right, the critique is, well, if everybody had skin in the game, lots of skin in the game, if you banned health insurance except for catastrophic illness, you would lower the cost because there would have to be transparency and there would have to be competition. I think that's ridiculous. And I was on this week with George Stephanopoulos the week before last, and George Will said that. He said, you know, if people had to pay their own, all these prices would come down. And I said, well, actually, George, we've been trying that experiment with 40 or 50 million Americans who don't have insurance, and it hasn't really worked out that way. So the one side, which I think is just patently undoable, because in the most extreme case, when you get wheeled into an emergency room, it's not like you're going to say, all right, can you take me to four or five emergency rooms around here? I just want to sort of check out what the prices are. And not just the prices, but I want to check out who says I have to have three CAT scans, who says I have to have two, and I want to read up on whether the guy who says I have to have three is right before I agree to three of them. You know, but even in cases of elective care, you can't do that with healthcare, and let alone negotiate whether you want this drug or that drug. I mean, your doctor has said this will cure your pain in your back. And what are you going to say? Well, let me look that up and see if it, I mean, you can, but it's just not realistic. You know, you could, but the average person probably couldn't. And then on the other side, it's, you know, let's just have, you know, single payer for everybody. I think if you had an option that said everybody can buy Medicare and we're going to charge you something less than Aetna's going to charge you because we pay so much less, that to me sounds like 2 weeks into now hearing all the policy people come back at me, that to me sounds like a pretty logical idea. It also sounds like the most impractical idea in the world, because you would be nuking all the insurance companies, and there are millions of people employed by insurance companies. It's a big sector of the economy, but it also is $200 billion of the overspend. We alone have a private insurance sector like that. So that does seem right. And even if I had thought it when I was finishing the article, I probably wouldn't have, you know, tried to push it in the article, because then the article would have been dismissed. You know, now I'm getting, you know, to the extent I'm getting attacked, it's, you know, Mother Jones on one side and people on the other side, which is sort of a good place to be, I think.
So even though this was kind of a small-sized book, mm-hmm. do you have any thought about going the next step and making some prescriptions and turning it into a book?
I'm actually now thinking about it. I wasn't until... the reaction to this thing has been by multiples heavier than anything I've written. Again, everybody, this affects everybody, and it's sort of a really interesting policy question. It's a really interesting consumer reports question. The stuff not in the book, including, for example, how to deal with your insurance company and how to read bills, which will be more important as people go into these insurance exchanges, I might cover. I'm also sort of interested and just sort of looked at it lightly and don't know much about it, how we evolved into this mess. I mean, what made us take a turn that no other developed country took? And how did we get there? How does it work in other countries? So I think there's a lot that's not in that article. I had one section, which is the only section I cut out, about how inefficient the insurance companies are. There was a section that had one patient who showed up in an emergency room in New Jersey and whose doctor had changed his rates the week before from $250 for a half hour session to $9,600, because he realized that if he was an out-of-network doctor in an emergency room, the insurance company had to pay him because he was giving emergency care and had to pay him according to his usual charges. So a bunch of doctors started doing this, and Aetna had paid this guy like $600,000 over the last 2 months for this stuff. They paid him, then they sued him to get it back. So my first question for Aetna was, I don't understand. If I send you something for $54, you question it and say it should be $42. How'd this guy get paid like that? And there were lots of, there were like dozens of doctors like this in New Jersey and in Texas and California and elsewhere, with insurance companies are now trying to get their money back. And they said, well, you know, we have so many claims, it's hard to catch them. And I said, well, can't you just like put something in your computer where like a bell would go off if you have to write a check for more than $1,000 to a doctor for one half hour session? Oh, that would be very difficult. You can't believe it. You know, and Medicare has all this stuff like that. And the insurance companies don't. And the reason is they really don't have to.
Right, because they're making so much money hand over fist.
Well, their profit margins are actually pretty low, but it's a nothing business. I mean, a monkey could do that business. It's just, you know, pushing paper. Their profit margins are the lowest of any people in the sector, but it's just administrative work.
I guess in looking at it and the whole idea that most hospitals make this pretty comfortable profit, I'm wondering why hospitals in New York, at least, seem to be dying, a lot of these community hospitals, and if you looked at that at
all. Yeah, because you said community hospitals, because as the larger hospitals lock up doctors, either they buy their practices or they make deals with them, you want to practice in our hospital, you can't send patients to other hospitals, the smaller hospitals lose market share. I mean, it is an anomaly that when I'm saying all these hospitals are profitable, you see, you know, St. Vincent's goes out of business, and that's why, because and also there is a pretty dramatic overcapacity of hospital beds in this country, which sort of defies the image and the reality of, you know, you see all these construction cranes at hospitals all over the place. But that's why.
And one question, did you get any sort of feedback or blowback for casting Medicare as this sort of like the kind of the panacea, like this is something good?
Yeah, I mean sort of rhetorically from
or even
from more conservative readers, but not any sort of factual dispute of how efficient they are. And how one of the ironies there is that Medicare, you know, for all the Republican calls to farm out Medicare to the private sector, Medicare is farmed out to the private sector. There are 500 government employees working for Medicare, and I think it was 7,500 or 7,000 private contractors. They're just more efficient because they work under very specific productivity standards set by the people who oversee them, and competitive bidding and everything else.
Just for all the folks in this room who I suspect at some point or another are going to be diving into something they don't know, I'm just interested in hearing you talk a little bit about how when you begin at the beginning of an investigation like this, what techniques do you use to kind of educate yourself and read in? Because clearly if you started from zero, you certainly got pretty far in this one.
An expectable answer. You just sort of start with the easy stuff. You know, you read basic clips about things, and then you dive in a little deeper. You know, I must have to sort of teach myself the insurance industry. I had printed out the massive annual reports from Aetna and Cigna and places like that, and then read the analyst presentations and listened to some of them. Same thing for the drug industry. There's lots of stuff. You know, I did what anyone would do, which is you pick people who you're sort of friendly with or you know, and you say, you know, who know this stuff. There was one doctor friend of mine, one person who's on the board of one of the big hospitals, and I took him to lunch and said, you know, just teach me about this. I don't know anything about it. How would you go about doing this? Their first reaction was, well, you're never going to get any bills. My first rule of reporting is that if 10 or 20 people know something, you can know it. You know, when we started doing the Am Law 100, where we get the profits of all the law firms are all private, I remember, and we just decided to do it, and one of the big firms in Chicago had 170 partners, and Jill Abramson and Ellen Pollock were working on that firm, and they came to me and said, Ellen said, well, we've called 40 partners, and they've all hung up on us. And I said, well, how many partners are there? She said, 170. I said, well, it sounds like you got 130 phone calls. And sure enough, on call number 71, you got something. So here, my approach to the bills was, I said, well, how hard can this be? I mean, yeah, it's got all these issues and privacy, but there are 200 million Americans who have bills.
Right.
Got to be able to get a dozen of them to look at. And I sent emails out to some friends and then found out that there was, by sort of looking online, that there were these advocates who try to get people's bills negotiated. So it became easier, but you just sort of start in the process. And the key thing is, with anything like this I've ever done, retroactively, if you look back at it, if I knew it was going to be this hard, you say to yourself, I never would have done it. But if you're just sort of wonderfully ignorant about how hard it's going to be, you just keep digging down. To wit, I've been thinking about doing an article like this for a long time, and was approached in June or July by Frank Foer and Chris Hughes, who had just bought the New Republic, and they said, we want to make a statement about how we're a different kind of Washington publication, and we're going to do long-form journalism, and do you think you could write something that will have the impact of the Rubber Room, which was the piece I did in the New Yorker about the state of public education
right. In
the country. And I said, well, actually, I've been thinking about this thing. And they said, oh, that'd be great. We'd make it the cover of our launch issue in January. We'll spend a gazillion dollars to promote it, so you'll have maximum impact, and we'll make a big deal of it. And you'd really be helping us get this important new magazine off the ground. And I said, okay. And I went home that night and talked to my wife, who, among other things, has been my business partner and the general counsel of all the stuff I've done. And I told her that, and she said, boy, you're a schmuck. How could you do that? And I said, well, this guy, nice guy, and they're going to do this new magazine, and it's going to be a different kind of long-form journalism, not the typical Washington publication. She says, nobody reads it, and you're going to waste your time, and you're going to end up having to email it to all your friends because no one's going to see it. And you're just stupid. You should give it to, David Remnick or The Times or somebody. But why are you doing this? I said, no, I really want to support this. This is, important. This guy's going to hire more journalists. This is going to be great. So that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. You're just stupid. And then as I went through...
I just have to say that your wife sounds like the only person I've ever met who is as blunt as you are.
No, she is. She's worse. She's a lot worse. Anyway, so as... And my kids all chimed in as they heard about it, too. They're in their 20s, and they said, are you kidding? Why would you do that? This guy really wants to contribute to journalism, and, I'm in the business of trying to make this happen in the other side of my life, so I really want to do this. So then as I went through the summer and I started getting all this stuff, like all these bills and seeing what was going on, and I tell my wife about it, she only had one reaction. She says, it's all wasted. Who cares? No one's going to read it. And I said, no, people, And she just was saying, no one's going to read this. You're just wasting your time. So I finally got Chris Hughes and Frank Foer on the phone in September, late September, early October, and said, listen, this is going to be big stuff. Tell me again how you're going to promote this and what you're going to do with this. It's going to be the cover of our launch issue, blah, blah, blah. And I told my wife that, and she said, it's ridiculous. So, and then at the same time, I went to some dinner party with a bunch of my friends. I remember Ken Aletta and somebody else, and I told them what I was working on, and they said, well, who are you writing it for? And I said, the New Republic. And they said, what? Why are you doing that? And I said, and I went through my whole speech, different kind of magazine, launch of a serious long-form journalism, blah, blah, blah. He said, oh, you're crazy. But Frank and Chris Hughes, more you know, much more so Chris Hughes than Frank, said, this is going to be, we're going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars promoting this, a whole PR campaign around it, blah, blah, blah. And this is how stupid I was that I listened to them. So cut to the second week in January. They love the article. It's about to close. They send me some cover artwork to look at, which was awful, but I sort of ignored that. And, everything was fine. We'd gone through the fact-checking and everything. And about 5 o'clock, the day before we're supposed to close, I got a call from Chris Hughes, who says, well, I've got great news for the magazine, but it complicates the publication of your article. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, we've gotten an exclusive interview with the President of the United States in the Oval Office.
Oh, my God.
And he said Oval Office about 6 times, you know, so much so that the 6th time he said it, I said, yeah, you know, the president works in the Oval Office. That's actually where he'd most likely do an interview. And I said, well, so what? What does that have to do with the article? He says, well, we obviously have to put that on the cover. I said, well, why? He said, well, it's an exclusive interview with the President of the United States in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. And I said, let me tell you something. I've done 2 of those in my life, and I was really excited by them. And I actually have experience interviewing people, and they were the worst 2 things I've ever done in my life. That, you know, sitting there are 8 people on the staff there. There's a stenographer typing everything he says, even though you have a tape recorder. It doesn't matter. I said, nothing's going to come. I said, what will happen is he'll say 1 or 2 things that will make it into the news cycle for, you know, 2 or 3 days. 90% of the time, they'll leave out the fact that he said it to the New Republic. I said, but unless you get him finally to admit that he was born in Kenya, you got nothing. And he says, well, it's the President of the United States in the Oval Office, you know, and I own this magazine. I'm the editor-in-chief, and I have a right to choose the... I said, well, you do. And in the course of the conversation, he says, and we've had this interview request pending for 6 months, and they finally agreed to it. So I said, oh, so when you assured me this was the cover of the magazine, what you meant was it's the cover of the magazine unless you get an interview with the President of the United States in the Oval Office, which, of course, you're going to get because your PR flack is Anita Dunn, who used to be his communications director. Obviously, you're going to get that interview. It's a no-brainer. He said, well, it's the President of the United States in the Oval. Anyway, long story short, I toyed with sending it to you guys, actually. But I decided first I would go to a couple of other publications. I really don't want to name them, but among them was Time and then the usual suspects you would suspect. And within, you know, 12 hours, which means 2 hours of reading and 10 hours of contemplation, since it was a long article, in one way or another, they all said, yeah, you know, we'll publish it, but... the others wanted to, like, publish half of it in print and the other half online, some combinations, or do it as a series. And Time said that Rick Stengel and Nancy Gibbs said, we'll do the whole thing. We just want to make a statement about this. We'll do the whole thing. We'll dedicate our whole issue to it. And that's how it came to be. So the New Republic, you know, decided not to run it, which is certainly their prerogative.
There is the news business.
Yeah, well, let's leave Dick out of this.
So, I was really, truly wondering what you think the prospects are for Time Magazine, for the Wall Street Journal, both of which have just been spun off, The Wall Street Journal has been spun off into a corporation that will only be dealing with the news part of Fox, and Time is about to, so we hear, be spun off.
With these two guys in the room, I'm going to opine on the business prospects of the Wall Street Journal?
Yes, actually.
Repressing your usual shyness.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Go ahead. So, tell us, what...
I think somehow, some way. This is going to be a really unsatisfactory answer. I continue to believe that somehow, some way, that people who supply important, valuable information are going to get paid for it. We may be seeing the start of that. I mean, our company, we're sending big dollar checks to B Billings, Montana, which has put a meter on their website, just the way the Times has. Will it be the kind of profit margins that you saw when every newspaper in every town, you know, had a monopoly and the Oldsmobile dealer had to advertise in the newspaper? Well, no, not the least of which is because there's no longer an Oldsmobile dealer. But I think doing good journalism can, you know, can pay. Time magazine, you know, a weekly news magazine has a special problem, which is their original role, which was to sort of, you know, to summarize the news and to tell you, you know, if the president, you know, had dinner with, you know, 12 Republican senators at the Jefferson Hotel, the traditional role of Time magazine would be to tell you what they had for dinner and what they talked about, because the Times and the Washington Post would have the news story the next day that they met, and then the background story would be in the weekly newspaper. Well, now the Times and the Washington Post are going to have the story of what they had for dinner and who said what to whom and what happened, because, you know, everything else is the news story that they had dinner. I mean, if you got up this morning and picked up the newspaper to find out that they were having dinner, you were way behind. You could have known that at 8 o'clock last night.
But Steve, let's take two other cases. We learned this week that two of the nation's largest magazine companies don't want to own Fortune magazine, which is a terrific magazine.
Yeah.
Right? And writes about stuff that is important to a lot of people. And the Boston Globe is for sale, and there's every reason to think that the enterprise value of the Boston Globe is, net of its pension obligations, less than zero.
Yeah.
And it will be sold for less than zero. So if the nation's great magazine companies don't want to own Fortune, and the Boston and the leading newspaper in one of America's most important cities is worth less than nothing, doesn't that give you some pause in that thesis?
Sure, it gives me a ton of pause. But it tells me a couple of things. If, you know, if you put some of the people in this room in charge of Fortune magazine, they can make it work. The Globe is a different kind of challenge, because regional sort of big metropolitan newspapers are being, you know, picked to death by more local websites. You know, I'm sure there's a website that, you know, does or will cover, you know, Framingham, you know, better than the Globe covers Framingham, and I'm sure that, so that's a different kind of issue. But, you know, leave aside the titles you're talking about, what I'm saying is something different, which is that I think a family in Lancaster, Pennsylvania will pay $2 or $3 or $4 a month to get coverage of their kids' high school sports team in the local newspaper, as well as, you know, coverage of what's going on at the planning board and at City Hall. You know, I just believe that, and I think that the people who are supplying all that for free are just going to, you know, continue to go out of business, because you can't. What the web has proven beyond all doubt in terms of digital content, and is now starting to prove in terms of video content, is that you can't make it on ad revenue, because the basic, you know, someone writing in, I mean, criticizing my article, said I should have taken Economics 101. I actually did take Economics 101. No
Except
further.
It was Econ 10.
Yeah, whatever it was. Econ 10, basically, if you have an unlimited supply of something that keeps growing, call that page views, be they digital or video, the CPMs just keep going down. Mm-hmm. So if you don't start to get paid by the people who are using the stuff as opposed to the advertisers, you don't have a business model. And I think the Journal's going to find that out with, you know, with all the video they're doing, which I have trouble imagining a lot of people are watching, but I have even more trouble imagining that the CPMs aren't going to come down. But the Journal doesn't have to worry about that as much, because people pay for the Journal online, and people pay for FT, and people pay for the Billings Gazette.
Not long ago, advertising revenue, as you're suggesting, was multiples of circulation revenue. This is a big nut. You once told me a story about your previous enterprise, the retinal scan enterprise, where you went to Cincinnati. Did you share with my colleagues?
Sure. I mean, this sort of taught me a lot about what was going on with ad revenue. When I started this company that had the registered traveler program, which, by the way, the government now does really well. We had big plans for advertising. Whenever we'd go into a city, and the example I gave you was Cincinnati, but it could have been Denver, you know, it could have been Orlando. Our ad agency, Ogilvy, would come in, and they'd have these plans, and, you know, not for television, because we were trying to reach, you know, mostly business travelers. That's who would want something where you use it if you fly a lot. So they'd have a plan to do the a strip ad across the bottom of the business section of the Cincinnati Inquirer. And then they'd have another plan to do something, a banner ad across the website, the front page of the business section of the Cincinnati Inquirer's website. Then they had these things I never heard of, something called Kayak, which is a travel site, a sophisticated travel site. And then they were going to do the Weather Channel for people in Cincinnati, their website, because people interested in the weather in Cincinnati would be there. And if you're interested in the weather in Cincinnati, it must be because you're flying to Cincinnati. Long story short, by the time we got good at this, we were able to buy advertising from the air travel sites, you know, Orbitz and Expedia, where the ad would only pop up if you were buying an airplane ticket to and from Cincinnati, which is by definition the audience we were trying to reach. So why would you ever care about having an ad on the business section of the Cincinnati Inquirer? And by the way, the newspaper Cincinnati Inquirer, the print thing, was like $16,000, and the website was $1,600, and Orbitz was, you know, $200. And we got better response from Orbitz. Once you know that, you know that the general interest newspapers notion, you know, the Times sells, you know, travel advertising directed at the page where Sharkey writes an air travel
Joe Sharkey.
Whatever your product is, it can be so much more targeted than just putting it, you know, next to Joe Sharkey's column. And you're spending all that money for all that New York Times circulation when you have no reason to do that. So pretty much any general interest newspaper, most of their advertising, unless it's branding advertising, like, you know, Tiffany's has a lot of ads on, you know, the homepage of the Times across the top. That probably makes some sense, but the reason it makes sense is it's not accountable. The person at Tiffany's has told himself, well, it's great to be on the front page of the New York Times. He has no idea how much, you know, product he's selling, and you know, if he's an editor, and, you know, Tiffany's really isn't asking him, because the CEO of Tiffany's feels great that they're on the home page of the New York Times. You know, but, you know, you take like Johnny Walker Scotch, they put an ad in, you know, a full page ad in Vanity Fair, and the guy gets to, you know, go to dinner with Graydon Carter a couple of times, maybe even gets invited to the Oscars party, probably not. But he has no idea how much scotch he's selling, right? I mean, that display advertising, they no idea. For any other product online, you know how much you're selling. And a general interest newspaper is never going to be able to produce the results, you know, the cost effectiveness of the results that these super targeted, you know, ways of advertising can produce.
You're one of the greatest recruiters of journalists ever.
And well, actually, Norm Perlstein was. He just hired everyone who ever worked for me.
Right. Yeah. And I've hired people who worked for you also, and it's a good rule. But so often, particularly when you were getting started with American Lawyer, mm-hmm. you were hiring young people who didn't have much of a track record. What's your process? Is it intuitive? You just have a
I think
nose,
it's a or? Lot intuitive, but there are a lot of mistakes. I mean, I deserve to do community services. I am the person who brought Nancy Grace to television. So let's take this all with a grain of salt, okay? I have a higher batting average than I might deserve, and there's a lot of luck involved. But I remember when early on I had recruited Jim Stewart because he was working on an antitrust case with my wife, and he said that he always wanted to be a journalist, and he had a resume that said he had been an intern at the local television station, and an intern at the local newspaper. And I figured, well, what could be better than that? And 5 years later, I found out his parents owned the local television and the local newspaper. Who knew? But anyway, so Jim, but at the same time I hired Jim, I hired another guy from a Wall Street firm. And we, about 6 months later, we set out to do for the first time our 10 best and 10 worst judges, you know, across all of the federal circuits. And it worked out, but the guy I hired with Jim, same great resume, Harvard Law School, same thing. On Wednesday, he hands in his pick in the circuit covering Virginia. Is that the fifth or the fourth? Yeah. He hands in his pick for the worst judge. And I start asking him questions about it. Well, what about this? What about this? You didn't prove this. You didn't prove that. So it's Wednesday. He comes back Monday and had named the guy the best judge. This was not going to work, right? You know. There are a lot of judges. The guy couldn't have swung that far. But it's a lot of instinct. But I also believe that you can train people to do the hard work. You know, we were a good training ground. And by the way, I used the journal to recruit, because after you guys started hiring a few people, I didn't have the attitude that, what's his name, that horrible guy who used to own The Observer, blanking on his name. You know who I mean.
Yeah, but I don't want to fill it in after that.
Anyway, his attitude was, Arthur Carter, his attitude was, if you left The Observer, and by the way, who wouldn't leave The Observer? You don't pay anybody there. Of course you're going to leave The Observer. You don't say, my idea is to, you know, support my children and grandchildren from my Observer salary, right? His attitude was, the day you said you were leaving, you were dirt, you were disloyal. And my attitude was, obviously, the place to start a journalism career was a place like The American Lawyer. And that was my same attitude with Court TV. You give people an opportunity, and if they get hired away, you use that to hire other people. So, you know, work here for a few years, and if you want to, you can go there. I mean, when we started Court TV, there was, we had a couple of experienced people, and then we had, and there was a producer there, a young producer, Cynthia McFadden. And she came in one day and she said, we don't have enough on-air people. She says in this room, you just don't know how to count. You don't know what you're doing. We don't have enough on-air people. It's supposed to be a, all-day television network. People can't be on all day. We need more anchors. And I said, well, what about you? And she said, what? I said, well, you look okay and you certainly talk a lot. Why don't, and you have legal training. Why don't you try it? So Fred Graham, who was our experienced guy, takes me aside. Oh, and then I did the same thing with Terry Moran, ironically, because they now both do Nightline. And Fred takes me aside and said, Steve, you really can't put people on television who don't have television experience. And I said, well, Fred, by that definition, no one could ever be on television.
and he started out in prep.
Right, and let's remember, Fred, work for the Times. But so that's part of the recruiting allure after a while was, well, this is a great place to go if you want to be somewhere else. After a while, people didn't necessarily want that much to be somewhere else, but you know that's just a fact of life.
That was Steve Brill. To see his landmark story, visit time.com and look for Bitter Pill. Thanks for listening. For ProPublica, I'm Mike Webb. We'll catch you later.